Okay, so we've been going through a lot of stuff. Like, I feel like every episode, every chapter we've covered in this book has been really big. Like, there's been big things happening, or at least leading up to really big things, great things to theorize about. But this is like, this was some chapters and episodes that surprised me with how massive and how much many implications there are for what's going on. So, namely being the interludes.
Welcome back to Following Noah on a Stormlight Podcast. This week is episode 254, and we are in interludes 11, 12, chapter 78 and 79, entering day 6 of Wind and Truth. Paul, how are you?
I am magnificent, ready to pick up where we left off, really excited for interludes, new and old, and just to dive in deeper. This is going to be a crazy episode. I'll go ahead and say that. I think we're going to have fun with this episode.
I think we're going to be bouncing around quite a bit to different things in this episode. Elliot, how are you? Yeah.
I am doing pretty good. Speaking of bouncing around, I commented in our Discord about this, that something hit me in this reading these sets of chapters that hasn't really hit me yet in any of our Brandon books. And that was, I was feeling a little bit disconnected from some of our like secondary and tertiary characters here. Interludes were interesting. They had me hooked pretty big. I mean, interlude 12. Oof, that's gonna be a chat. But chapter 78 and chapter 79, we get into some of those kind of side plots that we haven't spent a ton of time in. I mean, we get Sigzil, we get Renarin, we get Relaine, we get Venli, we get Yasna, we get a tiny bit of Shallan in chapter 79. And I was realizing that reading the book as slowly as we are, I mean, looking back, we've been reading this book for 6 months now, just about. And it is challenging. I think some of these secondary plot lines suffer because we're reading it so slowly. I'm not invested in like Renarin and Relaine and Sigzil nearly as much as I think I would be if I was binge reading this in 48 hours. Because it's been so long since we've even been like in their perspectives now. We've been going from so many different characters or whatnot. And I've not felt that level of like fatigue in any of the other books, I think, up until this point. But this book, this two chapters here, it finally hit me. Man, I'm not as connected as these other characters as I should be. I think it's because I'm reading it so slowly.
I understand that, what you're saying. I don't know if I had sorted through that to come to that conclusion as much as you had, but I could see where you'd get that. I'm not sure if I'm as disconnected with Sigzil as you're saying, but with Renarin, I think I agree with you. Elliot, could we get a summary of interlude 11, 12, 78, and 79?
Yeah, most certainly. So two interludes here in between our days. We've got interludes 11 and 12. 11 is one of the interludes that we got a preview of a long time ago, a couple years ago, and read it. And I'd almost forgotten about it until we flipped the page and I was thinking, oh man, we've read this before. And it's in Eerie. It's the perspective of the granddaughter of one of the interlude perspectives we got a while ago, who was a shoemaker who got killed by Nail. Her name is Dial, one of those two probably. She is helping her mom in the shop in Erie, and three strangers walk in and are ordering food and asking strange questions. And it comes out that the three are none other than Galadon and Demu, and then a third guy, Bayon, one of those two. Bayon. And they're asking questions about Spren. They're getting a little bit of information. We have a little bit of a showdown there. They get a letter from Hoid. These are the guys that are tracking down Hoid, alluding to the fact that we've seen these guys before, right? These are the dudes that have been tracing him around for a little while now. And then the giant Spren in the middle of the bay, Kusakesh, rises up, opens the portal, and says, time to go. So all the Eerie pack it up and head out, apparently. Interlude 12 gets pretty crazy. So Cultivation makes an attack on Taravangian city of Carbronth, sends her agents in, takes Taravangian's close friends and family hostage. Cultivation turns to Odium and says, all right, I've got your people. Give up or I'm going to kill them all. And Odium gets all sad because he's Mr. Emotions guy, right? But then says, I'm totally making this up. Do not test me. Watch what I can do. Smashes his own city to complete smithereens.
I have a lot to say about this 12. When we get there.
Oh, yes. We will get there. I'm taking too long with this summary, so I'll hit 78 and 79 fairly quickly here. 78, we get Sigsil, point of view. He's strategizing, trying to figure out what he's going to do. Chats with Layton. They're talking about, oh, yeah, Kaladin put us into these positions of leadership. We can do this. Venli POV, they're hiking through the chasms. They get the chasm fiends to lift them over this big log jam. Leshwe is still having her identity crisis. Yasna gets a few pages at the end of chapter 78 where she gets confirmation that the armada on the way to attack her is fake, or like 90% sure that it's going to be fake. So she's thinking about what she's going to do next. Chapter 79, we start with Shallan, who is just processing more of her visions and her situation. We get a little bit of Renarin, who's in a memory of his where he's getting bullied, and Adolin comes in to save the day. I actually really like that section with both Renarin and Adolin. It was a cool bit of chapter. And then a Relaine point of view where it's revealed that the only reason he was sent out to be the spy to go infiltrate the Alethi is because he was the only one there who was expendable. Ouch.
Ouch. All right. Let me start off with the most important topic. This was a big week for bingo boards. This was a massive week for bingo boards.
Oh, man.
Not only for mine did Cultivation kill something, but the Pure Lake fish were also mentioned in the previous interlude. I got two interludes. I'm on cloud nine over here. Anyone else get a cool bingo slot?
Rusts was used as an expletive.
Nice.
With Damu and yeah, with Damu and company. I'm pretty sure Damu was who said it. I don't remember exactly, but I know it was used. I didn't figure y'all would push back on it, but if I need to, I can go find it. But it was used, so that's on mine. It's been a second. I'm gonna have to pull my board back up to see.
Anyway,
I don't think I got any fully checked off on mine, but I'm getting close. I'm getting very close to a few on mine, so I'm feeling pretty good.
All right, let's talk about interlude 11. We had seen this one before. From this point on, officially, we are spoiler free because we had this one in the back of our minds technically, but not that it affects anything. But I've been waiting for this one for a long time because I was considering when this one would come in and knew this one would eventually show up. I was beginning to think it was like day 9 or day 8 based on like the, you know, the world is ending. We need to move on to the fifth journey or whatever Kusakesh says. So I was wondering if this was closer to day 8, but day 6. I mean, it's sounds pretty a pretty good middle ground, especially based on the next interlude and what Odium is prepared to do to play his cards. So if the Eerie were ever to get out, now would be a good time based on how interlude 12 goes. But we get Galadon and Damu officially, canonically in Stormlight. They've been here the whole time, but they are named, they are titled, they are described as Galadon, Damu, and Elliot. In the outline, you have Bayonne. You don't know who Bayonne is. Paul, do you know who Bayonne is? Do you remember?
I do not, off the top of my head. My guess is that this is either somebody from one of the shorter stories we've read, or this is another smaller Mistborn character, was my guess. But I did not remember for sure.
It is a trick question. You don't know who Bayonne is. I don't know who Bayonne is because he's from White Sand. That's all I know. Bayonne is in White Sand, and if Sanderson gets to the long form version of White Sand, which he said was on the calendar between now and Mistborn Era 3, that's supposed to be an actual like full book coming out, is White Sand. So I hope that is the case and we get that book, and I would read it then. But White Sand, that's the answer to your question, Elliot.
I was wondering if he was going to be a player moving forward, that this was going to be like the reveal of a character that's important, Mistborn Era 3 or something like that, which maybe that's still the case, but yeah. White Sands. Okay, that's the answer.
Yeah, he's from Tal'Dane, and I think Galadon Demu and Bayonne, from my limited knowledge of Silverlight and stuff, I think they're they're members of the 17th Shard, and they're trying to hunt down Hoid. And that's just been officially spelled out for us in this interlude, finally.
Trevor, I'm going to take over for 1 second, because I was surprisingly, I was really excited about my two words for this episode.
And did I forget about two words?
We glossed past two words, and so I'm going to go back. But I think it leads us decently well forward as well. Because we've been going through a lot of stuff. Like, I feel like every episode, every chapter we've covered in this book has been really big. Like, there's been big things happening, or at least leading up to really big things, great things to theorize about. But this is like, this was some chapters and episodes that surprised me with how massive and how many implications there are for what's going on. So, namely being the interludes, but the chapters themselves are really, really great as well. But my two words for this episode were rubble, which I'll come back to, and a word I don't know if I've ever used this word before, but impenitence. I have the definition here for clarity, but it's the opposite, if you will, of penitence. It means the state of being unrepentant, hardened, or lacking contrition for wrongdoing. And I feel like that is the best way to sum up Taravangian, as we've seen. Even going back to early discussions with Taravangian, it was do what needs to be done, despite whatever the costs may be. And with that, there's absolutely a massive lacking of guilt or sorrow or things like that. He has this whole like, oh, he's so emotional and he's so sad. But like, I don't think he's really that sad if he, you know, to be fair, he does say this, the difficult part is having the strength to do what needs to be done or whatever. But I can understand that, but I'm also like, okay, like you don't feel that bad. Like you're just moving forward. You're killing nations. You're killing all these people, even from way back before Izodium, right? Like he's killed tons and tons and tons and tons of people, and he's never like burdened by the weight of that. He doesn't stop, and we haven't really seen him stop and be like, wow, I kind of feel a little bit bad for all these people I've killed and such. So anyways, I feel like that was a good way to sum this up, and definitely shines through a bit in this, where he, the one thing that he's held on to is like, ooh, maybe this is his motivation to protect his family and his like country, his homeland. Then he himself is like, nah, they're gone entirely, like wiped off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of left like, excuse me? Like, okay, now what is there? What do we do now? What does he do now? What's his motivation. It's now, I guess, just world or universe domination. And he was like, oh, this is what's holding me back. It's my feelings towards my family. So I'm just going to take care of them right quick. It's quite harsh, quite crazy. And this feels like the serious point of no return. We had this whole stint of Taravangian, the divided one, you know, is the like potentially logical side, or this whole fluctuating thing he has going on, is that going to take edge over his ability to control the Shard of Odium and maybe, you know, maybe control it better than previous bearers had? Or is he going to give in? And it's like, well, that was a question. Now it's like 110% he is ruthless Odium, and there's not really any going back from here. There's no motive to even like justify. It's pure villainy rather than like, you know, a complicated villain where he's just doing this to protect his people or something. So anyways, that was just crazy. That was a absolute literal like bomb drop probably of an episode of a chapter there. Whoops. So anyways, impenitence briefly, sorry, rubble was my other word. And that is just the events that are happening here is crazy. I feel like I'm in the midst of an avalanche, but I have a hunch that this is just the beginning, the first few rocks and rubble to start falling, to really start an avalanche as we near the rest of this book. So, but going on and on, Elliot, you probably have two words as well, but I was excited to bring those up as we look at these interludes.
My words tie exactly into that, those topics that you're talking about too. And I even pulled a classic, combining my two words into one, or really substituting one for two, because it was so big and so representative of these chapters. The word, single word I picked was deluge. And it just felt like this was the, mainly for interlude 12 here that we're talking about, it felt like the breaking of the floodgates, that this is the moment where Odium lets loose, that this is, I don't want to say first time, that's kind of definitive, but it feels like the first time where Odium has really just gone, screw it, smash something. He's been very calculated and emotional and thoughtful and done things on purpose. This was very reactionary. This was very, you did what to me? Well, I'm just going to kill everybody. And that, I don't know, this feels like the start of a new Odium for all the bad reasons that you just talked about, Paul.
I agree. I read this, I more accurately listened to it while I was prepping dinner, and thought to myself, wow, this interlude 12, we can go ahead and dive into it, has to be the craziest single chapter that I've read in Stormlight, I think. Even beyond chapter 120 of Oathbringer, simply because we're redefining a villain again. Like we have Odium, we have Raze, and then he turns into Taravangian Odium at the end of Rhythm of War. And then we're left with the question of, okay, now what? Now we know now what. He's going to remove any leverage, any trump card against him now without hesitation. This chapter, at the beginning of the chapter, he was upset and torn and freaking out that Cultivation would actually act and kill some of his people. But by the end of the chapter, what he's willing to do, okay, now what is he not willing to do? Like, because he took out Carbranth, he's now willing to take out the continent. Like, it, in order to play his hand the way he wants it to be played, if another shard tries to interfere, he's just going to act. And there is no bind on Odium now. I have more to say, but what did you guys think?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that further, Trevor. So my understanding is our shards here, Honor, Odium, Cultivation, they're bound in some way to oaths and contracts and things. I know there's a lot of like red tape, it seems like, involved in what they can and can't do. And it's like, okay, if you attack this other shard or step out of line, that weakens you, and then another shard can come in and destroy you, right? I know that Odium is bound by the current contract that we talked about at the beginning of this book, where they're like, ooh, there's a loophole, and we have to fight over these cities, or you could lose control of them, etc. What are the bounds for Odium here? Can he just start smiting major areas? He just wiped it off. Like, he was like, see ya, Garbrandt. Like, smited the whole thing. Like, is that allowed? You know, is that...
Well, I actually have a direct answer to this, but Elliot, do you have any input before I go on a huge rant?
No, go ahead. I was going to look it up. There's a specific line in the chapter that talks about, because Garbrandt was solely under the jurisdiction of Odium, he can do this without opening himself up to retribution from other shards or something to that effect. The other question, Trevor, as you're about to launch on your thoughts, because I think you're going to have thoughts on this, but I want to make sure you weigh in on this if you do. You had some theories a while back about the importance of Garbrandt being like safe in all of this. Okay, please address that in your thoughts, because I have questions.
And it's really important to me. I think that this was set up brilliantly, if this is going where I think it's going. At the end of Oathbringer, Odium approaches Taravangian about the diagram and says, hey, you should come over to my side because the diagram shows that I'm going to win. Does the whole Sauron, Saruman thing. Okay, Taravangian's going to work with Odium now at the end of Oathbringer. The deal he strikes with Odium is save Garbrandt and everyone born into it. You have to save Garbrandt. That's what Taravangian makes Odium raise swear to. Okay. Dragonsteel 2021, I get on the mic and ask Brandon Sanderson, hey, we just got Rhythm of War. Todium now has the shard. Does that promise, does that oath still have binding impact? Does he have an oath with himself? And he gave me a Rafo, obviously. But I think this is where it's coming back into play. We haven't really seen it up until now. Todium just wiped out Garbrandt of his own accord. I think he broke an oath. Back to what you were saying, Paul, I think he broke a bond, a promise, an oath, whatever you want to say there. And you're right, Paul. The rules that we know of for shards is you can't do that. As a shard, it weakens you, makes you susceptible to other shards.
Well, yes, like the logic all makes sense, but the reading of this chapter, though, does not seem to imply that there's going to be any negative effects on Odium. In fact, it seems to infer the opposite, that because of that oath, he was able to do this. Like, maybe it is a breaking of the oath, but that's not going to hurt him because it's a breaking of an oath with himself.
And I think Todium believes that, but I'm not sure if that's true.
Okay.
That's the interpretation I would do. I think Taravangian is using that as, you know, what's what I'm looking for? Vindication, reason to be able to do this. But I think it's going to come back to bite him more than he thinks, because Cultivation's been warning him this whole book, you can't do this, you can't do this, like, you need to be more tame. And Taravangian has been the, I have the courage to do what it takes, blah blah blah, all of you guys are cowards, all the shards are cowards, I'm just gonna go full steam ahead. I think this actually does have ramifications that Taravangian doesn't know or is ignoring.
That could be true. That could be true, because this chapter is from the perspective of Odium. And it says things. Correct. In the chapter like this. It says Here's what the chapter says. It was an action he could not have taken anywhere else, for it was too direct an intervention. But Carbranth, he, as a mortal, had been promised Carbranth. That still held. And then the very last sentence of the chapter is, then Odium, god of passions, destroyed Carbranth entirely, the one city he'd bargained all his mortal life to protect. Like those sentences, it just feels like it's saying, he did this, but it's fine. He was owed Carbranth, so he can do this. But maybe you're right. Maybe that is Odium's own mind justifying that act. And this could come back later.
It's possible. If it, I could believe it, but I don't think that's the case. I think this was just the, it was showing cultivation, and it was showing us that Odium is not going to be manipulated or influenced. I think this was this is the one place I can actually destroy, like within my rules and regulations, within my terms of, you know, terms and conditions. And he just didn't hesitate, just did it. So I don't think there's going to be a direct impact from this. It's possible that something else could come of it, but I don't think this is him breaking an oath. I think, Elliot, you briefly mentioned that since it's not with somebody else, I think that's the key piece. Like, if Raze had done this, I'm sure that would have weakened him because he broke a promise that he made with Taravangian. But Taravangian made that promise with Raze, who is no longer in existence. And he himself, I don't think, was held to the same. Like, he has to protect it. He made Raze promise not to destroy it. But I don't know. It's possible that could happen. With that, do y'all have anything else to say on Odium, or can I talk about cultivation a little bit?
Real quick, I wanted to ask the question because I don't remember, and I didn't have time to look this up. Are Taravangian's grandkids in Carbranth at the time of the splash? Because I have vague memories of them in this book previously, and I feel like they're in Kolinar. Like, some interlude that we've had, he goes and visits Kolinar, and his grandkids are there or something like that, and then Cultivation comes and visits him there. Maybe interlude between day three and day four, maybe, something like that. I want to say his grandkids are not there, but everybody else that he cares about is there. And so I wonder if his grandkids are still a leverage point that we could hold. But I don't remember.
I'm not 100% on this, but I think they're in Carbranth.
Are they?
I think there is a mention of them before that you are remembering. I remember that too. I don't recall where exactly that happened. But in this chapter, as he's getting sad about what he's about to do, he thinks about his daughter and his grandchildren, and he names them specifically. And I think that's implying that he's killing them in that moment, and that he knows that he's doing that.
That was my understanding as well. I remember the chapter you're talking about, Trevor. I don't remember where it was held, but I think it was implying, my best memory and guess is that it was in Carbranth, and that was like the, oh, this is why I'm doing all this, to save Carbranth, because all my family is there. Think it implied that. And I think also with what Cultivation was doing in this chapter was also implying she had all the family hostage in Carbranth.
I'm conflating two interludes together. Previously, I think he goes and visits his family, and then he also goes to Kolinar in a separate interlude, and like he visits a hospital or something like that. But okay, so his grandkids are dead. That's the conclusion we're coming to here.
I think so.
Yeah, I think they're toast.
So he really does have no tethers to Roshar anymore, really, besides if you want to talk about Dalinar, but
it's like that there's other characters in the story he's interacted with, but there's no one else that we've seen him like be like, this is someone who I love and who I'm fighting for, you know? He mentions his respect for Dalinar. That's about the closest thing you get, I think, to anything else. So, really crazy. It was also crazy to read in this chapter that Cultivation was doing this. Was like, hey, I'm coming out of the shadows. I've got hostages, and I'm here to, I don't know, to try to bring you down or something. And then it just got wiped. And I think, Elliot, I think you wrote in our notes about like, what does she do next? Was this the last move? You know, that's exactly how I feel. Like, okay, we've had a lot of thoughts and evidence that Cultivation has been pulling a lot of strings from behind the scenes throughout this whole story. Did it come to this? Was this the final gambit? Is there something else? Or did ODM just be like, no, I don't actually care. There you go. And have a nice day. You know, I don't know what Cultivation does from here either. If y'all got any ideas, let me know. But I feel like Cultivation is kind of probably a bit shocked and wondering what to do next.
Played her hand and lost. Yeah, yes, I agree. I am wondering if she could go after him directly, like Vin style, but I don't think she will. That's the only other thing I can think of.
And I think it's a really relevant question for the rest of this book. What role is Corvellium Avast going to play in the back third of this book? Is she just going to retreat? Is she just going to say, oh, well, I made my move. I played my cards. It didn't work. I'll just hunker down and see what happens. Or is she still going to try and shape the events of Roshar here? I could also see this being a relevant question if Honor appears back on the scene. If somebody, Dalinar or otherwise, takes up the Shard of Honor, and now we have Honor back orchestrating things on the planet, does that embolden Cultivation? Is Cultivation kind of burned and is just completely out of this? I'm not sure what happens to Cultivation now. I kind of think I know where Odium's going. I think we've used this term already, probably prematurely. Odium Unleashed is what's on our hands now. But Cultivation, do we have Cultivation crawls into a dark hole and doesn't come back out again on our hands?
Something else in this interlude that stood out to me was the conversation that Todium and Cultivation or Corvellium Avast had. And I believe it's this chapter, right? That Teravagian says, like, you like war, don't you? Because you like these hardships that the people face, because it forces people to grow stronger. And that's something that kind of is in your nature, kind of feeds into the essence of Cultivation. And I had the thought also that, okay, guess a little bit of spoilers for Mistborn Era 1, but the dynamic is ruin and preservation essentially being at equal odds against each other. And it was like there was a little edge to one or the other for X or Y reason. And I'm wondering if we will see some surge in Cultivation amongst the people and our characters in this book, which could potentially create an edge for Cultivation to step in more forcefully. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen, but I'm trying to figure anything out that I can right now. I could see something like that of...
Oh, what?
You know, sorry, something along those lines. Yeah. That's about all I had, but I'm just thinking we have some pretty resilient characters. To name a few, you've got Shallan, Dalinar, Zeth, Kaladin, and basically everybody on our like allied side. And yeah, if there's any way that like I feel like they've been so exemplary that I could see that in some way strengthening a bond or developing some kind of bond with Cultivation and maybe provide, I don't know. It's a bit half-baked, but I feel like I could see something like that happening.
Well, let me fully bake it for you, because as you were talking, it actually sparked something for me.
Okay.
Dalinar, what if this event here, Cultivation tried to go it herself? She tried to take Odium down on her own. What if this makes her think that she needs to now go fully back Dalinar, and that Dalinar's her only hope to take down Odium? Jump over to Dalinar's perspective. Dalinar is stranded in the spiritual. He does not have any way to get home. Like, he may not even make it back in time for the contest of champions. What if Cultivation is how he gets back? We've seen Odium go into the spiritual realm and take actions in there. What if Cultivation can just step in there and pull Dalinar out? What if Cultivation is going to go into the spiritual realm, meet up with Dalinar, basically say, hey, you're our only hope, and pull him out so that he can go fight the contest of champions? Yeah. Mark that down. That's an official prediction.
Yeah, yeah. I really, really like that, because we've been playing this, like, I don't know, this, like, I don't know how to describe it. We've been doing this back and forth with the Stormfather and with Honor for a while now. And we keep waiting for this, okay, when's this breakthrough moment for Dalinar where he's going to bond Honor and come forward, you know, as a bearing a shard or whatever. This crazy thing to be on a level to combat Odium. Right. And this book, it's only gone south for him and his relationship with Honor, I feel like, or at least with the Stormfather. There's been tons of problems where the Stormfather just ditched, just pieced it out and left. So that does create an opening if Cultivation is now like, all right, well, that plan didn't work. This might be my only other chance, even though I don't like it. Maybe we'll aid Dalinar. Maybe we'll actually give Dalinar answers he's seeking, whereas with the Stormfather, it's all like, oh, stop looking for stuff. The more you look, the worse it gets, which is like the most difficult and challenging trope, I feel like, to read. You know, the stuff where it's like, oh, if you don't look for it, you'll find it, but if you try to find it, you won't. And, you know, it's hard to... It's a difficult logic game. So, I like that a lot. I think that's pretty plausible.
I'm more in the camp that Cultivation is down for the count. That it took a lot for Cultivation to do this. And that's like, Teyvengian is quite surprised that, you know, Cultivation could act in such a way. I think we might have Cultivation go hide under a rock. At least until day 10. I don't know if we're going to see her try something again until maybe the rest of the book. That's where I'm sitting. Anything else on the interludes?
I have a little more to say on interlude 11. Just going back to how crazy it is that we have like a whole people group just blow and dodge, just escaping the whole world. One of my words was rubble, and I used that as like a, I think we're at the beginning of like an avalanche, a sanderlanche, if you will. And I feel like this is a this in my head was the first stones to start rolling of like, okay, for whatever reason, Kusakesh has now awoken and is evacuating all the Eerie. Like, stuff just got real. Like, stuff is really about to hit the fan, and we've got to go right now. And, yeah, I feel like this is a really, really big deal. Like, reading a lot of interludes, you're like, oh, interesting. You know, like, that's a character. That's something that I learned, or something like that. Like, we had that Zile interlude a while back, and that was just, like, bonkers and bizarre, and you're like, okay, what's going on here? Is he going to be okay? But here is, like, this isn't the same. This is, like, okay, stuff is getting really, really, really real. You know, like, we have entire people evacuating Roshar now. So, I feel like this is, you know, we talked about, is Roshar going to make it in One Piece? You know, still going to exist after this book? That's still a very, very real possibility that Roshar does not exist. If it does, I think it is very possible that in some way, shape, or form, we will see other complete, like, major areas like Carbranth completely destroyed. We may have some places still intact, but I think we're going to see more places destroyed, like Death Star style, like destruction. And I guess the Eerie will be safe, but it's getting really crazy, really fast.
I agree. All right, chapter 78. Are we starting day 6 or day 7?
7. It's day 7.
Did I get that wrong in our intro to the episode? Anyway, we start with Sigzil talking to Layton, and they are chatting on the Shattered Plains. And then we get some Leshwe and some Yasna before we get back into the spiritual realm. So Sigzil and Layton are having a talk about imposter syndrome. And Sigzil says, well, Layton makes the accusation about himself that I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't even be a bridgeman, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't even deserve to be here. And then Sigzil flips it on him and says, yeah, Kaladin must have made a mistake by putting us in charge. And then Layton gets all defensive. It's like, no, Kaladin's the best person on the, you know, on the whole Stormin planet, blah, blah, blah. And then Sigzil gives him the look of, you know, that, see what I did there? If you trust him that much, you also must trust him that he made the right decision in giving you responsibility. And then Layton's like, yeah, okay, whatever. I understand. What do you guys think?
I really, really loved this conversation. You just summed up, like, the best part, in my opinion, of, okay, you can't pick and choose. You can't say, oh yeah, I absolutely trust Kaladin and look up to him, and then doubt his decisions because you are insecure in yourself, right? Like in an uplifting way of like, Kaladin chose you and I to lead and be a part of this, and then now you are wrongfully feeling insufficient, some imposter syndrome going on. And so now you're doubting that because of that insecurity. I thought this was just a really great scene. I loved it. I loved the message. 10 out of 10 for me. This may be more personal. I've struggled a lot with like imposter syndrome in general in life, like college, work, whatever it is, you know, like the fear that you're not supposed to be or you don't belong in the circle you're in. Whenever that's not true and you're there for a reason and things like that. Like I thought this was really well written and really, really well done. Yeah, nothing else to say other than that. I believe, but this was one of my favorite conversations between our remaining bridge four folks that are around. just really appreciated it. I thought it was really good.
It ends on a really powerful moment for Sigzil. The time that we have spent with Sigzil, he's been struggling with this leadership thing. And the last paragraph of the first section of chapter 78 leads him to the conclusion that he's made it. It feels like we get a resolution moment for him. The very last sentence is, Sigzil was at long last the man he'd always wanted to be. Like, that feels powerful. That's like definitive. He's decided, oh, okay, I can do this. I am a leader.
The amount of Sigzil we've gotten in this book, I've greatly appreciated. And to see him accept, it almost sounds like an ideal of I accept that I am the leader of these, of the Shattered Plains or whatever. Like, almost sounds ideal. Like, and to see him make strides like that is good. Now I fear of what's coming for him. Because, yeah, anyway.
I think he's fine, and I'm basing that just off of Zeth has said so many of these chapters, this book, and he's still alive right now, so.
Zeth is still alive?
Yeah.
Yeah, for now. We'll see.
For now, yeah. But he's had a lot of those chapters, so you don't have to be afraid yet. We know if anything happens, it'll be at the very end of the book anyways. So
That's fair.
I feel okay for now. But I do want to echo that I really loved having Sigzil in this book. He's had quite a major role. Ever since we had the bridge cruise in The Way of Kings, I think Sigzil was my favorite member of Bridge Four. Aside from like Kaladin and the main peeps, I guess. I've just always liked him. The concept of the World Singers is really cool to me. And yeah, really, really cool character. So I've enjoyed getting more Sigzil POV. I also just think his name is really cool. Maybe I'm a sucker for that, but anyways.
His name is pretty cool.
Yeah, Zellion's cooler.
Zellion is cooler. Sunlit Man spoilers. All right. Venli and Leshwe are headed towards the center of the Shattered Plains with their Chasm friends. Not technically riding Chasm Fiends yet, although Chasm Fiends have lifted us over some rubble, to use your word, Paul. But we have not technically ridden them yet.
It's getting so close. Like, they've talked about it, and then here, yes, the Chasm Fiends are literally picking up the humans to lift them. But yeah, the writing, have we actually seen it? Ah,
it's rather comical at this point of we have not technically seen them writing on page yet, but it'll come.
I was going to say, I think we're bound to see it. It's been hinted at enough that he can't just not make it happen.
Right. Chekhov's Chasm Fiend. All right. We need the source of the song. Venli. Venli is talking to a Chasm Fiend about the song getting stronger towards the middle of the Shattered Plains. Turns to a Chasm Fiend. Oh, you're just as excited about this song as I am. That's pretty cool. Keeps going. Prediction time, gentlemen. We're headed towards the source of the songs at the center of the Shattered Plains. Where's this reveal headed? Is this Honor's explosion site? Is this a new shard? Is this an old Roshar thing that we're going to go find out? Where's your guys' headspace with this one?
Well, they've already told us a little bit, right? We got a reveal a few chapters ago, 10, 20 chapters ago, that it was a moon that crashed to the surface at the Shattered Plains. So I would go along those lines and say that there's a meteor or a moon that has landed there. Maybe there's something to do with like some special investiture that was in that moon, and there's the source of the songs or things like that that could be there. I don't know, we throw the name Dawn Shard at everything, so why not this Dawn Shard? There was Dawn Shard in the moon, and it landed on the planet, and now it's buried in there. That's all I got.
But does the fourth moon mean fourth shard? Because we've been told up to this point that 3 equals 3, so does 4 equal 4?
We brought that up earlier, and there is some uncanny correlation to the existing moons and the current shards we have, at least just going off the color of them. So fourth moon, fourth shard, maybe.
A thought I have with that, by the way, so I think that'd be really cool, and that somewhat logically makes sense to me. And we've theorized that for a long time. Trevor's had a long-standing theory about a fourth shard being on Roshar. As we just read these interludes, I'm like, we need something. We need a serious, like, pulling something crazy out of the hat to beat Odium in this situation. That would be something really crazy out of the hat, but it almost feels too bailed out. That is under the assumption that there's a fourth shard here, and the fourth shard comes in and just is like the buzzer beater, like, answer to beat Odium, right? If there is a fourth shard, that's probably not going to be the case. But if it is, I might be a little sad, a little disappointed, of like, almost feels like a freebie cop out to survive.
Yeah.
I do have another question for y'all briefly. Talking about the moon crashing into the planes, right? I have on my bingo board that we learn what shattered the planes.
Mm-hmm.
Does that count? Did we learn what shattered the planes?
Not yet.
Okay.
Well, we will. I'm 100% positive that we will, but not yet.
Okay.
The chapter before, they didn't like sit us down and tell us what happened. It was more like in the song of the chasm fiends or something like that, or one of the stories of old is this. So I think we need some more evidence before we cross it. Very, very likely, okay. I think we're getting your answer, Paul, but.
Okay. That's fair.
And then we have Yasna in chapter 78. Yasna and Queen Fen have done their reconnaissance overnight and have come to the conclusion that, yes, indeed, the fleet sailing full speed Fourth Aelin City is a ruse. And Yasna is stuck with the decision of redeploy myself and my troops or not. Yeah, and that's about it with the Yasna point of view. Do you guys have any thoughts on the... she makes the conclusion that she's going to the Shattered Plains, which, if you remember, they bring it up again to justify that decision. But apparently, the Oath Gate at Aesir, where Adolin is broken. So they can't actually redeploy there. The only place they can is the Shattered Plains. I assume that's not happening. I think the Shattered Plains is hosed and that she's not going to show up there, but she might. I've definitely made the big assumption that she's going to Aesir somehow, but that's not the conclusion that she has right now because the Oath Gate is blocked. Any thoughts?
I think she will go. I think she will show up at the Shattered Plains, right? Nothing to base it on other than I'm just taking the word of this chapter right now. I feel like I spent too much time in my own head, not because it was hinted at, but in my own head, spending too much time thinking about what's the right choice, what is the right place to go to. And I mean, I don't have any answers for you. I feel like it's really just a relief that she gets to try to go back someone up to begin with. I feel like the rug has got to be pulled in some way. It's not going to work out, but yeah, we'll have to wait and see. This Yasna's story has really been ramping up for me of like, I was not expecting one of our three battlegrounds right now to be like a facade, like there's not actually anyone there and they get to go back somebody else up. I wasn't expecting that. And so I'm kind of along for the ride of seeing how that's going to play in big at some point.
Anything else? All right. Into the spiritual realm. Shallan wakes up in her childhood bedroom. Finally, I mean, not finally for Shallan, but, you know, the scene has been coming for so long. And we still don't get anything. I mean, Vale shows up and she goes, wow, this is crazy that we now remember. What do we do with this?
It has been amazing how we could keep going a step closer to this reveal of Shallan's mother and not arrive at the destination. It's like, it's bad. I'm so like, wow, this is kind of crazy at this point. It's like, it's gotta be the next Shallan POV, right? But I thought that like two Shallan POVs ago. So
it's the exponential curve where you're like slowly approaches the zero, but never actually getting there. Elliot, what's that term?
Approaches, but does not equal. Yeah.
Right. Asymptote is what you're thank looking you. For.
Infinitely approaching. Yes. The Shallan reveal, but never actually arriving.
Yeah. That's exactly what we're looking at.
I had a realization as I was reading this section of this chapter with what I think Brandon is doing, because clearly he's dragging this out as far as we possibly can. And I was kind of tempted up until this point to think that he was honestly doing this for the non-attentive reader or the non-involved in all the theories, and truly like trying to string this out into the biggest reveal later that is going to catch someone by surprise. When I feel like this is going to catch absolutely no one by surprise. But I think he's doing something different. I think he's not trying to drop a big bomb. I think he's trying to make this reveal happen as late as he can so that we have to watch Shallan face it. I think if he had done it earlier, if the very first time we saw Chanarach and Shallan in the same area and it was revealed, it would be like, oh, okay, that's done with, moving on. He's trying to, it's coming across as a bit of a tease. I don't think he's meaning it that way. I think he's assuming that we know, and that we know, and it's not in question anymore. And what is being done to us is a little bit of tension that's meant to feel like tension for us, because that's where Shallan is. Shallan knows the truth too, but she's trying to get herself to the point where she accepts it. And Brandon's trying to make us feel a little bit of that too, even though it comes off a little bit strangely. I think he's doing it on purpose is what I'm saying.
It's not so much of as a complaint to me, because I really have no issue with pulling it out and Shallan, like, you know, how do we handle this? I don't know how to handle this, and talking to Vale, and I don't really have an issue with that. I just think it's funny that we've been talking about this for so long, and all we want is that two sentences on the page, and we still haven't got it. It's just comical to me. But yes, we get Shallan. So Shallan, Renarin, Relaine, and maybe our Spren too, have all kind of like been scattered in the Shattered Plains, in the spiritual realm, and they're all facing their own demons, if you will. So Shallan goes to her childhood bedroom. Renarin goes to some back hallway in Kolinar to face down some bullies. And Renarin goes back to the middle of the Shattered Plains to talk to Eshinai, I think. So let's go to Renarin. What do you guys have on Renarin?
First of all, I'm sorry. I gotta say it. I've got to just say a little brief, I told you so. I think I've done this before. I said when we were going into the spiritual realm that all of our characters were going to be dealing with their past struggles again. And so far, that seems very true. So a very brief haha. Neener, neener, I told you so to you too. Second of all, this was sad, like a sad flashback to watch, but it provided such good insight for me to Renarin's character. The trope of being bullied, being bailed out and defended by his older brother, and then wanting to not let that happen, wanting to step up to not have to rely on an older brother. And this, I instantly thought of the part in Words of Radiance where Adolin is in the duel and Renarin jumps in, honestly, as a little like foolish jump in of like he's not prepared to fight, but he's just jumping in to help his brother. Instantly thought of that and got a little bit of chills of like how that moment may have been, thinking back through this like flashback that Renarin has. Overall, I thought really, really well written, really had me gain a lot of sympathy for Renarin's character. Most of the back story we have for Renarin is that he is like had trouble fighting and gets queasy and things like that, and has never like stacked up physically to his brother and to the other like young lords and princes and such of this world. But yeah, but seeing that in seeing this perspective was interesting. I have some more thoughts, but I want to go ahead and pass it off to y'all if y'all have things to say on this. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was a really impactful scene.
This was my favorite segment of these chapters for sure. And I love the relationship between Renarin and Adolin. I was contrasting this in my mind too, kind of comparing it, setting it alongside the iconic scene. Oh no, it's so iconic. I should know this. Words of Radiance, right? The honor is dead, but I'll see what I can do. Caliban is not the only one who goes to Adolin's rescue or attempts to go to Adolin's rescue. Renarin does too. Renarin charges out into that arena to go save his brother who's being picked on by a bunch of bullies, essentially. Adolin's been kind of baited into this duel, right? And tricked into facing more opponents than he thought he was. And here's Renarin trying to step in and help in the exact way that his brother did for him when he was younger. Really cool. Really cool parallel.
Yeah, I agree. I wish we had more young Renarin and young Adolin than we do. I feel like there's a cool brotherly relationship that we really haven't explored as much as I wish we had between the two of them. But yeah, I did enjoy Renarin having this really nuanced relationship with Adolin of really appreciating him, sticking up for him, but also having that feeling of I should be able to do this myself. Why do I need Adolin to come help me with these, you know, older boys? I thought that was a really good sentiment and really well written, putting on the page.
Another thing that I want to point out is Renarin's maturity looking through the lens of this flashback. When he sees through his modern like eyes, sees the kids who are bullying him, he doesn't necessary. I mean, he, you know, there's some like traumatizing like stuff for him, but he doesn't necessarily see these other kids and fear. He notices how fearful they are, how insecure the bullies are, which I thought was a really, really cool moment and a testament to Renarin's maturity here. There's so much, I mean, I'm no expert in it, in the psychology of this, but my understanding is there's so much psychology with bullying that's rooted in insecurity and wanting the trying to control or domineer over someone or something else out of a place of personal insecurity and things of that nature, wanting to have control of something. And I just thought that was a really good, it was a pretty minor detail. He just mentions pretty briefly that, like, he sees these other kids, these bullies who he feared as a kid, he sees them now as fearful and insecure, you know? And I just thought that was a very fascinating and mature mention and notice, and a really cool insight into Renarin's character, because just from that one comment, I just got such a clear picture of Renarin as just level-headed, like just not like being observant and being thoughtful and attentive, even in this flashback of a really tough, bad moment for him in the past. So that's a really small detail, but I thought it was really rich. And I really loved it, Elliot. I agree. I feel like the interludes in this episode shine so brightly because crazy things are happening. But I hope that doesn't overshadow for readers the cool moments like that we get in this chapter, in chapter 79. Really liked it. Really thought that shone brightly. Yeah.
Another heavy hitter to me was the Relaine section right at the end here. Relaine gets a flashback in the middle of Shattered Plains with Esh and I, and somebody brings up the idea, oh, we could send some spies to the Alethi camp. We could put them in dull form, and that's different than no form at all. Or it's different than no form at all, but marginally, so the humans won't notice. And then they, Thude, one of the higher up listeners in the early days of the listeners, volunteers and says, yeah, okay, I'll go. And then everybody's like, oh, wait, no, hold on, Thude, we can't send you. We need your expertise in battle. Like the few battles you've been in, we really need that. You're unexpendable. We can't lose you. And then everybody turns to Relaine and nobody has the same. Nobody has the same reaction. I was like, oh man, like, dang it. So I felt relayed in this episode.
Oh yeah. My heart dropped there. You saw it coming too. Cause there's a couple of people there in that scene. They go through, oh, we can't lose Esh and I, we can't lose so-and-so, we can't lose so-and-so. And you could picture the scene. All eyes just turn to the last one there. Oh, Relaine. We could send him. I was like, oh no, that is tough.
Yeah, this one physically hurt to read. Like you've already said it, but especially knowing what we know about Relaine and his time in the bridge crews and everything, and his progression from there of like, he's never really been able to feel like he's a part of whatever group he's a part of. And my heart just aches so much for Relaine. It's so like challenging and tragic. Yeah, this hurt to read. And you're right, Elliot. You could feel it. You could feel it boiling up like throughout this whole scene that like Relaine is going to be the one that they're like, oh yeah, sure, you could go. And yeah, it hurt. It's a sad way to end this this episode, I suppose, but I'm hopeful that I feel a lot better about the group that Relaine is with now and being accepted, so I guess that's something to look forward to, that these are looking back at the sad and the hard moments that these characters have gone through. But
yeah. Anything else for the beginning of day 7 for this episode?
No, I don't think so. A lot of different elements going on here. Some big interludes and then a whole bunch of our secondary and kind of third tier characters as far as like airtime kind of thing. So a lot to keep track of, but good stuff.
Yeah, this was a super, super exciting episode. I think I loved every like moment of these chapters, so I'm really excited to see where it all goes. Also, just a very quick shout out, because I'm really proud of it. I got a new mug, and it's got a bunch of Yoshis on it, and I just thought it was really cute, and so I wanted to briefly show it off. It's even got a little apple on the handle for Yoshi to eat, I suppose. So, yeah, excited for next week, showing off the mug. Very cool.
I thought you were going to actually have a shout out, but you were just shouting out your own purchase.
Yes. Yeah. I yeah, exactly, Trevor. I've been quite challenged to find more and more vessels to drink out of that I have not already, and so I did buy a new mug, Trevor. Thank you very much. Got a lot of episodes to go, so odds are I might have to buy another. We will see.
All right. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot. We will reconvene next week with episode 255, chapters 80 through 82 for anyone following along. See you next week.
See ya.
Toodles.